Today on Inside Politics, two roads diverged on a campaign trail. One nominee is talking to voters in a must-win swing state, while the other is choosing to be inside a courtroom in a must-win criminal case. Will Donald Trump's courtroom strategy work in a general election like it did in the primary? Plus, an obstacle to peace. That's how Chuck Schumer is describing Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The highest-ranking elected Jewish official in U.S. history is calling for new elections in Israel while also decrying the rebranding of Hamas terrorists. And TikTok may need a U.S. owner and fast. Trump's former Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin says if Congress forces its Chinese owner to sell, he wants in. I'm Dana Bash. Let's go behind the headlines and inside politics. First up, Donald Trump is inside a Florida courtroom as we speak for a hearing on his classified documents case. And Joe Biden is heading from one battleground state to another, trying to keep his coalition intact, the one that helped him win the White House 4 years ago. Yesterday, the president spoke to voters in Wisconsin. Today, he's in Michigan. Next week, he'll hit Arizona and Nevada. CNN's Jeff Zeleny is in Milwaukee, where President Biden is about to take off and head to the state next door. Jeff.
Well, Dana, as President Biden sets to leave Wisconsin on this windy morning here, he clearly is about completing his first lap of these critical battleground states in the week after the State of the Union address. He'll be heading to Nevada and Arizona, the western part of the battleground, next week, and then finishing his battleground tour in North Carolina at the end of the month with Vice President Harris. But there is no doubt the travel that we have seen over the last several days is a travel he'll be taking over the next several months leading into November. But look where he's going. He's going to Saginaw, Michigan this afternoon for an event there. If you look at Saginaw, Michigan, it's one of 25 counties in America, only 25, that over the last four election campaigns voted for President Obama, President Trump, and President Biden. So this is a bellwether county inside a bellwether state. If you look at the margins there, so interesting because the margins in Saginaw County effectively represent the margins overall in the state. 4 years ago, President Biden won this county by 303 votes. So that is why he is going there to campaign. So we will see, as you pointed out, the strategy of these two presidential candidates so different. Donald Trump in a courtroom he does not have to be in. President Biden on a campaign trail he desperately needs to be on to make his case to Democrats first and foremost to come back into the fold that he's up to the task here and then to pivot. But Dana, one interesting thing the president did before leaving Milwaukee, he spoke to a radio station here, largely a black radio station targeting African-American voters in an audience. And he said this. He said, "The guy I'm running against hurts black people every chance he gets." Not much context in that remark, but certainly interesting in the sense that that also speaks to President Biden's strategy, trying to really rebuild that coalition that brought him into the White House that he so desperately needs now. He'll be leaving here in a short period of time, going to Michigan, later back to the White House this evening. But we do now know that this battleground is set. It's up to the voters now to decide over the next several months how they listen to all of this, Darren.
Thank you so much, Jeff, from a very windy Wisconsin. Those stats about Saginaw County in Michigan are so fascinating. I'm so glad that you brought that to our attention. Thank you. And I want to now turn to CNN's Kristen Holmes, who covers the Trump campaign. Kristen, this is the first time that the former president is in court since he effectively clinched the nomination.
And Dana, just as Jeff said, he doesn't have to be there. He could be on the campaign trail just like President Joe Biden is. And what was so striking, and obviously, you know, this is clear, but looking at the map of where Joe Biden is going and has been, those, again, are the same states that Donald Trump's team has said are absolutely critical, but he hasn't been to many of them. Now, he instead has chosen to be in this courtroom, and it's behind closed doors. This is not one of your traditional Donald Trump using the courtroom as a campaign trail stop, because we're not going to see the former president today. He is not going to give her any remarks. He's not going to come out. He's not going to go to any microphones at a camera, because there just aren't any inside of that courthouse. Instead, we are told that he wants to be there. He wants to participate in his own defense, and he wants to signal to the judge that he wants to participate in his own defense, whether or not, you know, that works as a tactic. It is, we're told, he wants to be doing. The other part of this is what it actually looks like when he is forced to go into that courtroom while he's on the campaign trail. And that is expected to start at the end of the month for that New York hush money case. He is expected to be in trial when it actually starts every single day because this is a criminal case. Donald Trump's team is planning for that. They are planning for how to build a campaign around this trial, meaning Wednesdays when they're not in court, Saturdays when they're not in court. Those are the days that he could be on the campaign trail. Donald Trump himself has said he wants to be in court in the morning and then be on the campaign trail in the evening. If you talk to his advisors, they acknowledge that that seems highly unlikely, but they are trying to juggle this because, again, up until now, up until the end of the month, he will have chosen to be in court these various times, not been forced to be in court.
So interesting. Thank you so much, Kristen. Appreciate that. To discuss all of this and more, let's talk to our great political panel here, CNN's Lauren Fox, The Washington Post's Tyler Pager, and CNN's Eva McKend. This is your maiden appearance here. Thank you for coming on. Let's start with you about kind of this juxtaposition that we're seeing today between the two candidates, Biden and Trump. And I know you do a lot of reporting inside the Biden world about how they view the way that they can try to use this as an advantage, not just the fact that he has the ability to go out and talk to voters, but more tonally.
Yeah, this is the exact split screen the Biden campaign has been waiting for months. They are now both the presumptive nominees, Trump and Biden. Biden is on the campaign trail talking to voters, talking about his agenda. And as Kristen just outlined, Trump is in a courtroom in Florida, nowhere to be seen. And this is not just about, as you said, the physical location of where they are, but using this as a message to drive home to voters that Biden is not someone that's facing many criminal indictments, someone that, you know, is going to be in court many times over the next several months, but can go out and do things and achieve things for the American people. And I think that's the message that they want to see the president hone in on as well. How much he talks about Trump, I think, is the big question, right? Some of these cases are being charged by Biden's own Justice Department, and that creates an awkward tension here where Biden doesn't want to get too involved in those cases and try to stay away and show that the Justice Department is doing this independently from him. But it's still the reality that Trump is facing many criminal indictments that is while Biden is out on the campaign trail.
Yeah, and very true. And where we go with the campaign right now, it's sort of nice to take a peek to see where we are. Fox did a poll in a few states over the last few weeks, and what they found, and we'll put it up, Pennsylvania and Arizona, two critical swing states, it's basically static. We haven't seen a major move, whether it's from the president's State of the Union address or any of these other things that we're talking about. So that's the sort of baseline, and it's similar not only nationally, which matters less now than the battleground states, but also other battleground states as well.
It is, but now obviously it's very, very different because the choice is clear. So I think maybe in the weeks ahead we'll see those numbers shift a little bit. Another interesting point from that poll was how important to voters being mentally sound and honest and trustworthy are. Those were sort of their top concerns. And where honest and trustworthy, Biden got high marks, Trump got higher marks when it came to being mentally sound. And so this aggressive schedule the next couple of weeks, it really gives the Biden team an opportunity to insulate themselves from some of these arguments about his age. Even if he stumbles at certain points, retail politics still works. And so if he's crisscrossing the country, talking to voters about the issues that matters, that kind of puts a hole in this sort of obsession about the age narrative.
Speaking of age, this is going to be an interesting transition that I'm about to make. Let's talk about Social Security and Medicare, because this has been a very hot topic in the last 24 hours or so between these two candidates. Very, very important. It always is. But listen first to what President Biden said about Donald Trump on Social Security.
Just this week, Donald Trump said cuts to Social Security and Medicare are on the table. When asked if he changed his position, he said, quote, there's a lot we can do in terms of cutting. I won't cut Social Security. I will not cut Medicare. Instead of cutting Social Security and Medicare to give tax breaks to the super wealthy, I'm going to protect and strengthen Social Security and Medicare to make the wealthy begin to pay their fair share.
Let's look at what the president is referring to. Donald Trump was on CNBC on Monday. Listen to what he said there.
So first of all, there is a lot you can do in terms of entitlements, in terms of cutting, and in terms of also the theft and the bad management of entitlement.
Then a couple days later, yesterday, he tried to clean it up, Lauren. He said to Breitbart, I will never do anything that will jeopardize or hurt Social Security or Medicare. We have to do it elsewhere, but we're not going to do anything to hurt them.
This is the issue that congressional Republicans, people who are running down ballot, do not want Donald Trump to touch with a 10-foot pole. This is an issue that turns voters out. This is an issue that scares older voters. This is an issue that matters in the election. And that is why Joe Biden is so happy to talk about it on the campaign trail, why he is so happy to point it out in State of the Union speeches, which he has done over the course of the last 2 years, because he does want to drive home a difference between them on this issue. And it's why you see Trump trying to clean it up. It can be true that a lot can be done to redo, to rethink how we deal with Social Security and Medicare in this country and how we try to drive down the country's debt. That is a conversation that Republicans candidly would be happy to have, perhaps not in a campaign year.
Well, Nikki Haley sort of tried to go there a little bit.
It's dangerous.
That wasn't the reason why it didn't get far, but it was interesting to see. What are you hearing from your sources? I mean, I'm sure, again, the Biden campaign is like, you want to talk about cutting Social Security? Bring it on.
I mean, they have enjoyed this opportunity since the last State of the Union in 2023, when Biden's, you know, off script sort of sparred with Republicans in the House chamber and got them, in his view, to agree to not cut Social Security. And that was something that a lot of allies and aides of the president were like, look, Biden is sharp. Biden is able to tussle with Republicans. And they were really excited about that. We saw him try to do that again in this State of the Union, trying to draw out Marjorie Taylor Greene and other Republicans, trying to show that he has that fight in him. And so this is an opportunity that they would love to talk about. Obviously, people that benefit from Social Security other benefits are the ones that are more reliable voters. They're the ones that are turning out to the polls. And that is the reason why, as Lauren just said, congressional Republicans are really worried about this.
And another block of voters that Democrats have been hoping turn out for them are women, female voters, particularly suburban female voters. And to kind of help that along, if you will, the vice president is making a pretty historic trip. She is going to go visit a Planned Parenthood clinic today.
This makes a lot of sense to put this issue front and center. We saw during the midterms where Democrats defied expectations. And you even saw some voters who historically supported Republicans because this conversation became about liberty, became about choice, because it was so existential. They voted for some of these moderate Democrats. So I'm interested to see where they go with this. I know that they are making this a number one issue. They're even competing in North Carolina this cycle in a real way, which is really interesting. Democrats have historically suffered a lot of heartbreak when they've tried to compete in that state, but they think that they have, I think, a better chance this cycle because of issues like abortion.
Yeah, I mean, this is also an issue that has become really dominant on the Hill. When you talk, Mike Johnson just this morning was pressed on whether or not there should be national legislation to protect IVF. And his argument is that this is a state issue and that he supports IVF. He thinks it should be done in an ethical way. Obviously, there are questions about what you mean by the term ethical way. But this is becoming not just about the issue of abortion, but now Democrats are seizing more broadly on just reproductive care at large. And I think that that message, even if you might feel one way about abortion if you're a voter, you may feel differently about IVF, which is why Democrats are trying to make this a larger conversation.
And one of the things that I just think is fascinating about this is that it's Kamala Harris that is going to this clinic. Joe Biden, a devout Catholic, has long been uncomfortable with the issue of abortion. It is not even a word he said in his State of the Union address. It took him a while as president. There was a running clock of how long it would take him to say the word abortion. Obviously, Kamala Harris has seized on this issue, made it a priority for herself. But it's interesting, an issue that has been so successful for Democrats electorally, the president has not been out front as the champion of the issue because of his own deeply held beliefs about it.
Yeah, and she has certainly taken on this mantle and taken it on very willingly. Stand by, guys, because up next we'll talk about Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, who just called for new elections in Israel, saying it's time for Prime Minister Netanyahu to go. What Schumer said in his lengthy and nuanced Senate floor speech and why the GOP leader responded, calling it grotesque.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life wherever you get your podcasts.
Chuck Schumer isn't just the Senate majority leader. He's also the highest-ranking elected American Jew in the U.S. government. He said today that he knows that means his words on Israel carry extra weight. And the words he used today tried to capture the complicated and volatile situation 5 months after Hamas's terror attack inside Israel. But he clearly knew what the headline would be. His criticism of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his call for new elections in Israel. CNN's Manu Raju is on Capitol Hill. Manu, he said the only way to get to a place where everything calms down is to be committed once again to a two-state solution. He believes the extremes on both sides, Hamas and Gaza, he said the very right-wing government of Netanyahu's government, those are preventing this path to some form of peace.
Yeah, and look, this really underscores the growing unrest within the Democratic Party over the handling of this war and the calls for the top Democrats to do more in going as far as Chuck Schumer just did. It is significant because he is not in line with the progressive wing of his party on the issues of Israel. In fact, he has been an Israel hawk for most of his career. Back in 2015, he lobbied against the Iran nuclear deal, aligning himself with Bibi Netanyahu against Barack Obama. But in this case, he is hearing concerns and now voicing those concerns, saying that it's Netanyahu himself who is an obstacle to peace and calling for new elections in Israel.
The Netanyahu coalition no longer fits the needs of Israel after October 7th. The world has changed radically since then, and the Israeli people are being stifled right now by a governing vision that is stuck in the past. I believe that holding a new election, once the war starts to wind down, would give Israelis an opportunity to express their vision for the post-war future. Of course, the United States cannot dictate the outcome of an election, nor should we try.
And this immediately provoked a furious response from Republicans. In fact, the Speaker of the House held a hastily held press conference in West Virginia, where they're having their annual retreat. The Republicans are in the House railing against Chuck Schumer. And then on the Senate floor, Republican leader Mitch McConnell went after Schumer and called his remarks grotesque.
It is grotesque and hypocritical for Americans who hyperventilate about foreign interference in our own democracy to call for the removal of a democratically elected leader of Israel. This is unprecedented. We should not treat fellow democracies this way at all.
And it's more than just rhetoric, Dana. There are billions of dollars on the line, aid to Israel, hung up in the Senate and the House, unable to get that through the United States House. It is tied up into a larger debate over foreign aid, including aid to Ukraine. But this position by Democrats about how Israel is waging its war will only undoubtedly make it harder to get enough Democratic support to get that Israel aid over the finish line. Dana.
Manu, thank you so much for that. I want to bring in Susan Glasser, staff writer at The New Yorker. Susan, thank you so much for being here. You've covered the Middle East extensively for years. Also, kind of the way that diplomacy works and doesn't work. And as I was listening again to Schumer, I was wondering to myself whether or not this was a bit of a wink and a nod, because the White House can't do this. But he obviously feels passionately about it. And again, I want to emphasize, this was a very long, very nuanced speech, intentionally so. I was told that he's been working on it for about a month. But the fact that he's calling for new elections, what do you think the backstory is here?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, Dana. He is saying out loud what many frustrated officials inside the Biden administration might like to say publicly but can't, which is that Democrats are done with Netanyahu. They are extremely concerned about his prosecution of the war. I was very struck by the language that Majority Leader Schumer used in saying essentially that Netanyahu is prioritizing his own political survival at the expense of Israel and Israel's partners, unstated in the United States. This is a political moment. Schumer's speech was addressed, I think, to Democrats here inside the United States, many of whom are extremely fed up with President Biden's support for the Israeli war and how it's being prosecuted in Gaza. And I think that what you heard there is something that, you know, you might have heard from a lot of administration officials if they could speak freely.
So that was definitely, I think you're absolutely right. He was expressing the frustration among Democrats with Israel. He also had a message to many in his base about his clear frustration and, frankly, it sounds like horror at the fact that Hamas, a terror organization, is now being lauded as the good guys in some corners. Listen to that part.
It was Hamas who assassinated more moderate Palestinian political representatives in Gaza in 2007. It is Hamas who has held Gaza under repressive, undemocratic rule for close to two decades. And it is Hamas who targeted those brave Gazans who have spoken out against its actions or tried to bridge the divide between Israelis and Palestinians. Jewish Americans and Israelis alike have been appalled and hurt at efforts to rebrand Hamas, which is designated by the United States as a terrorist organization, as noble resistance or freedom fighters. Attempts to excuse their horrific actions against both Israelis and Palestinians are morally repugnant.
Translation is like, don't lose the plot here, Democrats.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, look, he's trying to open up some political space in what has become a very zero-sum debate about Israel and Hamas in the United States and in other countries in the West, where one is either supporting all the actions of one or of the other. And, you know, for Schumer, for many Democrats, neither one of those positions is appealing. But mostly, I think you're really hearing just an election year cry. The status quo not being acceptable. It is now taking a toll inside the Democratic coalition in a way that Democrats worry could affect both President Biden's reelection, could affect the unity of the Democratic Party. Pretty remarkable also, as Manu's reporting shows, to hear Republicans crying about the hypocrisy of Democrats in criticizing Israel. I would note that it's Republicans in the House who have held up the spending bill that would supply both Israel as well as Ukraine with urgently needed funds in these conflicts. So again, there's the rhetoric, but there's also the real world policy debate.
Yeah, and I'm sure you would agree. I don't remember a leader calling for new elections inside the country of a close ally. Certainly in my lifetime covering politics and covering international affairs. I'm guessing you would agree with that as well, Susan. Thank you so much. Appreciate you coming on, putting everything in perspective. Two days ago, Donald Trump became his party's presumptive presidential nominee. Today, he's playing a different role inside a Florida courtroom. Defendant. Right now, Donald Trump is inside a Florida courtroom as his lawyers try to dismiss charges in his classified documents case, or at least push back the trial. It's a strategy we've seen the Trump legal team use in practically every case. Delay, delay, delay. CNN's Caitlin Polance is outside the courthouse in Fort Pierce, Florida. What's happening inside, Caitlin?
Well, Dana, we're on a lunch break, but there has been a lot of arguments made already in court this morning. So far, Trump's lawyers are arguing that these are his personal records that he kept after the presidency, that Joe Biden had national security records, too, and was not charged with a crime. But the morning's arguments were focused around one question. Is the law clear enough about protecting national defense information? Trump's lawyers are saying to the judge, it's too vague. This case should be dismissed because Trump couldn't figure out that he would be breaking the law. Now, Judge Cannon, she did respond to this argument at the very end of the 2 hours of this morning, saying finding a statute unconstitutionally vague, as Trump's team is asking, that would be an extraordinary step for her to take. So she is indicating a little bit there of what she thinks on that particular argument. But there's more to come this afternoon. And the Justice Department, Dana, is digging in here. They're pointing that Donald Trump should have known what was going on and what the law was, not only because he was president, but also he acknowledged it on tape. Here's him at Bedminster, audio that the Justice Department also has and is using in this case.
Yeah. See, as president, I couldn't have declared it. Yeah. Now I can't, you know, but this is
yeah, classic. Now we have a problem.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So, Dana, that discussion that Trump had on that audio recording, it was something the prosecutors referred to during the hearing this morning. They're back after lunch, and there's going to be more arguments being made. Back to you.
Caitlin, thank you so much for that. I want to welcome my legal guests on this and many more topics related to Donald Trump and his court cases, CNN's Paula Reed and former Florida judge Jeff Swartz. Paula, I want to start with you here to kind of give it a big picture look at what we're seeing here. What, first of all, what they're doing inside that courtroom today. I'm going to show our viewers a bit of the filing that the special counsel filed as it relates to this Florida documents case. Trump's immunity claim here is so wholly without merit that it is difficult to understand it except as part of a strategic effort to delay. The court should deny the dismissal motion and certify Trump's immunity claim as frivolous so that he cannot use this meritless argument. You can almost feel the frustration coming off the page of this because, and I'll show in a second what I mean by this, but this is only one of the cases where he is intentionally trying to delay, hoping that he wins and all of this goes away.
Exactly, because if he can delay the two federal cases until after the election, if he's reelected, he can make them go away. And every hearing, every filing, every motion delays things a few days, a few weeks. So the fact that Judge Cannon is taking time to hear arguments on this case helps push it back. Though Judge Cannon has surprised us a few times, it's not expected that she will dismiss this case. This is all about timing, which is why another thing we're looking at today is any clue that she gives about when she's going to put this case on the calendar. It's currently penciled in for May. About 2 weeks ago, she heard arguments on how far she can push it back. The special counsel is asking for July. She said that's unreasonable. So August is the earliest, but even having these arguments delays getting it on the calendar. Delay, delay is the name of the game.
That's right. And Jeff Swartz, Paula just mentioned the reaction from the judge so far before the lunch break, Judge Cannon. And, you know, it sounds like we all like to read tea leaves when we listen to what judges say and don't say in these in these cases. She certainly seems open to the arguments that Donald Trump's lawyers are making.
She seems to be open to them, but I don't think she's going to go anywhere that close to dismissing the case. Mm-hmm. That's not something that she's already been spanked a couple of times by the 11th Circuit. I don't think she wants to face that a third time. The real concern that I think she's going to look at is the trial date, the idea of occupying the space in the late summer and early fall so that when the immunity case comes down, there's no room for Judge Chunkin to be able to set the D.C. Election interference case for trial. This is really the strategy, that is to eat up the space and leave no space for anybody else.
That's really interesting, especially if you look at the totality, and I mentioned I was going to get to this, of what we're talking about. And we're going to put on the screen for our viewers the four remaining cases that he is facing. Classified documents case. The earliest timeline would see trial in August. This is, and Judge Cannon is the judge for this case. Federal election case, trial date decision waits for Supreme Court action in early July, the action about whether or not he will or won't be granted immunity. And then, of course, the Georgia election case, the trial is delayed because the judge is considering disqualifying Fani Willis, the lead prosecutor. And then there is the New York hush money case. There, the trial is scheduled to start March 25th, Paula.
Look, their strategy so far has been successful. They should be feeling quite pleased with themselves because they have tried every conceivable way to delay these cases. And you see right now, the only one that we're confident is going to go before the election is the hush money case. The district attorney is framing that as the 2016 election interference case, but it is arguably the runt of the litter when we talk about the seriousness of these four cases and the charges there, allegedly falsifying records over hush money payments made to an adult film star. It's not clear that even a conviction there would change the hearts and minds of voters. So if it turns out that's the only case that goes, that is an enormous victory for this strategy.
Jeff Swartz, can you just elaborate a little bit more on what you see as the tactics that Judge Cannon is using in Florida right now in the classified documents Sure. case as it relates to this very important question of the calendar?
Sure. What's happening here is that she's taking a look at the time that it's going to take to try each case. Mm-hmm. She knows that Judge Chunkin on the D.C. case is tied up with a stay. And that stay, the earliest it'll be lifted will be when the Supreme Court reaches their decision. I still think it's going to go all the way to the end of the term. So her idea is that the earliest Judge Chunkin could bring her case to trial would be sometime in August or early September. If she sets her case and sets it for the middle of August, Judge Chunkin in the D.C. case will not be able to set her case at least for 5 or 6 weeks into September, well, all the way through September. Now you're at October, and now you're looking at a case that could pass, if it starts in October, could last as long as into the election itself. Mm-hmm. And that's something I don't even think Merrick Garland will approve of. So she's trying to fill that gap and avoid anybody else from going to trial while she has her trial date set.
I know you want to.
This has been one of the outstanding questions. Is the Justice Department willing to take this case to trial super close to the election, even through the election? And in the last hearing before Judge Cannon, the Justice Department said those 60 days outside of the election, where usually they don't take investigative steps, they say that doesn't apply here. That does not, in their viewpoints, first time they'd ever said it, apply to criminal cases. And I think that's something, though, that would actually just spark more litigation if they tried to do it.
Yeah. Okay, so we've said this so many times that it's probably going to become a drinking game at this point, but we cannot say it enough that the Trump legal strategy and the Trump political strategy are so intertwined. They're basically the same. Thank you so much for giving us the legal perspective. Appreciate it, both of you. Up next, if TikTok is forced to sell, a former Trump cabinet member says he wants to buy it. That's next.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. Join me, Philip Nguyen, a scholar of Vietnamese-American culture, and the cast and crew as we discuss the making of this historic series. Subscribe now to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts and stream HBO's The Sympathizer starting April 14th exclusively on Max.
Former Trump Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin says if TikTok is up for sale, he wants to buy it.
I think it should be sold. I understand the technology. It's a great business, and I'm going to put together a group to buy TikTok.
You're trying to buy TikTok.
I am.
Mnuchin says he's assembling a team of investors to make a bid if, a big if, Congress forces its Chinese owners to sell it. Axios senior media reporter Sarah Fisher joins me now. Sarah, the first question is, let's just assume, just for the sake of this conversation, that that the Senate passes it and that the president signs it into law. Big, big ifs, as I've said, that is 50-50 at best if that actually happens. But if it does, talk about the actual practical implications in the short term. Because if I have TikTok on my phone, that's not necessarily going away, right?
Nope. So what they would do is they would remove it from app stores like iOS App Store and Google's App Store. And what that means is that even though it doesn't go away from your phone, you can't update the app. So in the short term, you would probably be able to use TikTok. But in the long term, if you can't update it, the app becomes obsolete. You know, you can't get new product features, new security things. But also in the short term, remember, TikTok will likely file an appeal. Uh-huh. They could ask for a temporary injunction to stop the law from going into effect while it gets sorted out in the courts. And if that's the case, then they wouldn't even have the power to immediately stop it from being downloaded in the app stores. So people are wondering about the political implications of this ahead of the election. I don't even think that's a possibility at this point that we wouldn't get TikTok on our phones by then.
Yeah, interesting. So the immediate reverberations would not happen pre-November. But just looking at it from a higher level, so you have Elon Musk, who owns Twitter, now X. In a world in which a Donald Trump Treasury Secretary owns another huge media platform, even though it would look very, very different, TikTok. What does that say about the influence over these really important social media companies and platforms that have so much impact on people's lives?
It's huge. I mean, the fact that you have Meta, which is controlled essentially by one billionaire, Mark Zuckerberg, you have Elon Musk controlling X, now potentially TikTok. You have a lot of power concentrated in the few. And that's so ironic, Dana, because the whole point of these social media platforms is to democratize power, right? To democratize voices. But I'm glad you brought up Steve Mnuchin's bid, because the key thing here is that what this law says is not that TikTok is banned. It's that it will get banned if they don't sell it to a U.S. company or U.S. owners. And selling to a U.S. company would be really hard. Today's antitrust climate makes it really tough to imagine that a company like Microsoft or Oracle or Meta could just outright buy TikTok. Smaller companies wouldn't have the capital to do it. Mm. So you're looking at private investment groups being the most likely case. Now, can Steve Mnuchin rally enough American investment dollars? That is to be seen.
Yeah, and never mind the fact that what makes TikTok TikTok is the algorithms,
yes,
which are in China, owned by China. They're the black box in China, and they won't leave China, which is part of the reason we have to take a break. But that's part of the reason why national security experts are so worried about it, because they don't know what is actually in those algorithms.
Absolutely.
It would also change TikTok dramatically without those. We could talk all day about
this. Yes, we could.
A platform that I've never been on. Up next is Secret Life Revealed, the story behind Jim McGreevy, the former New Jersey governor and first openly gay governor in the U.S. Former New Jersey Governor Jim McGreevy is hoping for a second act in politics 20 years after coming out as gay and resigning in the same speech. My colleague Jake Tapper spoke to McGreevy for his series United States of Scandal.
Governor, thanks so much for doing this.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So your story is so interesting because you were living a lie, the secret life. How did you justify this to yourself? Was this just, well, this is what gay men have to do, and I just have to pretend to be something else, and lots of other gay men are in politics pretending? Like, what?
I didn't wake up and say, you know, I'm going to be deceptive for the sake of deceiving. I'm going to create this whole double ledger. No, I didn't make that decision prior to a gubernatorial campaign. I made it, like, at 7 or 8 years old. I can remember this as if it were yesterday. I go to my local public library and I'm pulling out the card catalog looking for the word homosexuality. And it said underneath, see psychiatric illness. And it was just like, whew, this thing, at least then in America, called gay, wasn't a good thing. I realized at that point in time that life is going to be a very painful trajectory if I own this. And you just try to make an accommodation, albeit an unhealthy accommodation.
Okay, I'm hooked. You can catch the United States of Scandal on Sunday, 9 p.m., right here on CNN. Thank you so much for watching Inside Politics. CNN News Central starts after the break.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.